Hello there. I'm Michael Williams. I'm here with the good man, David Coggins. This is Central Division. This week, we're doing Consumer Reports. Hello, sir.
Hey, Michael.
What's up? We're back.
I'm back in New York. It's officially mayhem now. I mean, people are on the streets. It's like I've never known the history of humanity has never so many people have not eaten on the street.
I mean, how long can this last? I heard someone on the Daily talking about eating outside. It's going to get chilly soon. And
I don't know. I feel like anyone's looking for an excuse to do something celebratory or social or see their friends. I haven't gotten to that place yet. Like it still terrifies me. And just, I think there's something about having lived in New York for a long time to see these restaurants that are basically like in the street. That still is slightly alarming, which I realize makes me sound like I'm 100 years old, but and I hate eating outside in New York anyway, for a variety of reasons. And so it's just a strange situation.
Does it feel more European?
Not really. It feels more like, you know, that place near where I live that used to be on the corner. It was like a sports bar that was shaped like a triangle. I've forgotten the name of it, but oddly Hunter S. Thompson.
Oh yeah.
It's called like the Riviera or some nonsense like that. And they had some of like what I consider to be the worst outdoor seating in America on this little point next to a ton of traffic and a bus stop that just constantly in exhaust fumes in the sun, eating terrible food. And now that's kind of, I don't want to say that's everywhere. And obviously we want restaurants to do well and whatever they have to do. And it's nobody would have chosen this, but it isn't like sitting outside in Rome or something.
I'm surprised, honestly, that there hasn't been more innovation around like coping physically for restaurants with the pandemic. I'm not talking about putting plexiglass walls around people, which apparently doesn't do anything. That's what I've heard. But I'm surprised there just aren't more, like, where's the like vending machine, like store, you know, that where's the like contactless, like pickup at every restaurant? You know, I actually went to this place. California like seems a little bit more suited to this just because the year-round weather is not as extreme, high or low. But I went to like I went to pick up donuts for my daughter for her birthday. Amazing. At Sidecar in Santa Monica, this like amazing donut place. And they just have like outside, you order on Google via Postmates. Then there's like a table under like a little tent outside. You just go up, your order number's there, grab it. You don't have to go in or do anything. And it's like, oh, this seems like simple, but I'm surprised that you just don't see more of that. It doesn't seem like it's that complex to try to innovate around it. You know, like those little windows in Florence where the plague window, you know, where you could like, sure, stick your hand out.
I feel like people are, I'm guessing that it's hard because they're having to navigate kind of city regulations and then they're trying to manage their staff. And they're just trying to follow certain protocols that they can't then like get into product design, even though that is like obviously what should happen. But
it's easy to like dream this stuff up when you're just on your podcast. You know, probably harder to execute.
So you're impaired. You can't golf because of a hand injury.
I've played basically no golf this year by my standards, and it looks like it's just going to continue. I'm just working on my mental game.
Huge by my standards, just huge like disclaimer that you tossed in at the end. But what happened? But you hurt your hand.
Yeah, I broke. I have a boxer's fracture, which I broke actually riding my bike, not the new bike that I got. Don't worry, that bike is still brand new and never been ridden, which is ridiculous because I waited like two and a half months for it. I just like slipped on a piece of wet path and the bike just like went out sideways and I like broke my fall with my hand. And it was funny. I went to like urgent care and the lady was like, "Oh, what'd you punch?" And I was like, "Actually, here's the road rash on my leg to prove that I fell on my bike." But yeah, so now I have a ridiculous cast with my fingers like split apart. It's horrible. And I can't type. I discovered something really amazing though.
What's that?
Amazing in terms of just technology and whatever, but the iPad, I have the Apple Pencil, mm-hmm, and I have the iPad, and you can write now in a few different programs, actually like all over the iPad, but, and it will, you just hand write things out and it turns into text.
It's the dream.
So I think that's going to be my solution, because I can't type to save my life.
Can I ask, is there like a good way to break your hand where you're like, oh yeah, I mean, is it actually better to have punched someone because that's a better story? Or now that you've had to tell it probably 100 times and you broke your fall, like it always feels like however we are injured, there's a better way to have been injured.
I think if punching something... You know, it's funny because I was in, my wife's friend is a orthopedic doctor in Philly, and I was texting him and trying to figure out like what I should do, where I should go, how I should deal with this. Not that it's like a huge deal, but I just wasn't sure exactly who I should see or what process I should go through. And I was talking to him and he was like, yeah, we only really see this in like old people and like adolescents who punch their locker. And I'm like, I guess it's better that I didn't punch something. Yeah, I only have 4 weeks in this cast. So I think by a break standard, it's not, you know, it's not terrible, but it's first cast of my life. First broken bone of my whole life.
Yeah. Broken bone.
I'm just getting old, you know. What can I say?
We're going to talk about what are we calling this? Like, we're buying things, investing in things, spending money. That was our theme for this episode.
I guess, you know, someone said when I started the newsletter, I read some criticism that someone's wife was saying, "Oh, you're going to pay to get this newsletter, and then they're going to like force things on you to buy." And that's the relationship, which I don't think is accurate, but it's kind of funny. I was thinking more like we could talk about the things that we buy, where we buy them, and what maybe the thought process is around buying things. And it could be anything like a suit, something, you know, super perishable that you just want to buy inexpensively, something you want to buy that's long lasting. Seems kind of interesting.
I like it. Well, what about your bicycle? You were just talking about that. That seemed like something you kind of tracked down, have yet to use.
Yeah.
You're kind of a researcher. Between the two of us, I feel like I obsess and you research. Or is that a fair?
Yeah. I mean, and it's funny because I think part of the idea to talk about this week came from just a conversation we had on the podcast last week and a mention of Consumer Reports, and then some people from Consumer Reports kind of tweeting at us, you know, mostly tweeting at me, but you, I think, were collateral damage there.
I had no idea these people worked for Consumer Reports. We never would have mentioned it otherwise.
I mean, I think I said, I haven't reviewed it, but I think I said something to the effect of Wirecutter was sort of like Consumer Reports, which is not true. And Consumer Reports is obviously, you know, probably very sensitive about that comparison. So I think that they were perturbed by the conception that they're, or the idea that they're, you know, similar things, when Consumer Reports is this independent, journalistic, not unpaid, you know, very trustworthy body that's, you know, long history of service there, and Wirecutter is like an affiliate play. So I get it, you know, but it made me think like what, so with the bike, thinking about research or whatever, I wanted to buy a bike that was still made in US, and there's not a ton of options. And then, you know, I think it's interesting, like a lot of bicycles are just made in Taiwan. Like everything's made in Taiwan. It's, you know, the bike industry is like consolidated into there, which isn't bad. It's just, that's where everything's made. And I mean, not everything, but a lot of stuff. And so I was asking friends and thinking about it, and I'd been out of the bike game for so long. So much had changed in the time that the last time I was in the market for a bike. But I just knew I wanted to buy a US made bike. And so I ended up buying this bike from Allied, which is in Arkansas, and it's like carbon fiber. They make it there. And, it's just like, to me, I waited a long time for it, which was fine. I think I waited, part of that's like the big boom and cycling right now because of the pandemic, but I think I waited 10 weeks, at least 10 weeks.
What do you mean? Like you tried to order it, and that's how long it took them to fulfill it?
Yeah. I mean, I think they built it for me.
Sweet.
So, yeah. So, I mean, I think that's part of the deal. Like they don't just have all these bikes probably sitting waiting to just get shipped out. They make them to order, which is cool. But yeah, so I had to wait a long time, and now I have it and I haven't ridden it, which is, you know, perfect. But I think it's, you know, there's a lot of ways that you could look at what you, you know, depends on what you want to spend and, you know, what you care about. Of course. Right.
Well, it's like there's this part of our mind that's like rational. And then there's a part that's makes us do things that we probably shouldn't do. And we need to kind of manage both those sides. And sometimes doing something impulsive can end up being wonderful. And sometimes doing something impulsive can end up being like a big, huge pain in the ass. And you're like, why did I buy this? Whatever it was, usually because it's on sale. And once I realized that I was like really making mistakes on sale, then I started to realize kind of a ton of people make that mistake where they say, like, it's if the first thing somebody says, I used to joke about food, right? Like if someone says it's healthy for you, that means it doesn't taste good, right? Because if it was good, they would say it tasted good. So, and if somebody says that they got something and it was this price and it was marked down to this, that's usually a bad sign too, in a weird way, because it means that they were like, I used to think that if you just put a big number on a price tag and then put a line through it, put another smaller number below it, line through it, and then another thing below, you're like, whoa, it was $7.95, marked down to $2.89. Hey, look at all this. I'm practically, they're giving it away. I'm saving $500. Like, no, you're not. You're still paying $289 and you don't even like the thing. or the fact that nobody wanted it or there was something about it. And like, I got so excited about things, and I'm not the only one. That's the idea of like a flash sale. That's the idea of like they're trying to get you caught up in that moment where you think you might lose something or whatever it is, the day after Thanksgiving when people line up outside Best Buy and start acting like crazy people. Or now they do it online at Amazon, and they like try to get you like the thing isn't going to last, and then you really can't trust your judgment. So my response to that was like, as we were talking about last night, I'd never go to the Barney's Warehouse sale, but don't even go like close to things like that, because I would just get like caught up in the moment, you know?
Yeah.
Every
time I clean out my closet, there's like all the giveaway stack is always like the sample sale stuff that I bought or something I bought on sale, or something someone gave to me that I didn't, you know, that just kind of came my way or whatever. A lot of times like that's, you know, the things I really want to buy don't typically go on sale because it's not a seasonal thing. Like a lot of times it's like the white Gitman Oxford, like it's not going on sale. It just never does, you know? And, you know, to me, it's like, that's kind of a good thing. I think a lot of the stuff that goes on sale is like this highly sort of seasonal, right, stuff that like maybe you wear for a little bit and then forget about or don't care about.
Well, it's almost as if people are, it's not even a judgment because we've all been, it's like you've got to approach it a little more scientifically and say, well, what do I need and what do I want and what matters to me? And then seek those things out, whether it's a pair of Crockett and Jones shoes or a bicycle or whatever it is. And once you know that, then you can be more strategic about it. But the problem is that it gets hard to do that because we like to go into stores or look at websites or something happens. And I used to have this rule for myself. I don't know if we talked about it before here, but it was, if I went to a store back when we did those things, if I was in Bergdorf Goodman and I saw something, I was like, oh my God, I would leave and go back to it and look at it again. Be like, okay, I still like it. And I would leave and go back and look at it again. So three times I would leave and go back to it. And the weird thing that happened is that the newness and the kind of the rush of ownership kind of wore off by the third time, because I was so familiar with it. It wasn't about the high of possessing it. And then if I still wanted it the third time, then I would max out my card or do some idiotic thing and buy it. But at least I gave myself some time to get over the like the rush of buying something, because that thing, that power or excitement, that's real. And I kind of had to break that circuit.
Yeah. Do you always do that, or that was just like a moment in time of doing that?
Well, I like looked in my closet and I'm sure everyone's had some moment like this where you're like, I've got 20 of a given thing, and I would really rather just have 5 way better versions of the 20, whether it's shirts or shoes or something. So then I thought, well, how much money do I spend on a category? And if I budgeted or at least like set aside something and only bought one version of that thing, an expensive version a year, that would be worth 5 bad ones or whatever. Let's just say shoes, right? So you buy like, you like plunk down for the Alden Chuckaboo, which I freaking love. And I hate the price, but it's like $600. I'm like, that's terrible. But if that's the only thing you buy in the year and you have it forever and you freaking are thrilled every time you, like, you absolutely know you love it, you'll never not love it, then that's like a pretty good thing. Mm-hmm. But you have to like stick with the one, got to stick with that. You can't then be like, oh, well, now they're doing this other thing on sale and I'm going over that. You just have to get the one and stick with it. And so I feel like that's one thing I did. And then the other thing at the other extreme is that if you're traveling and you're in a place where you see something that's wonderful and there's only one of them, you have to, then you have to act and get it. So like I was just up in Maine and there's this crazy place, this antique barn, immense, 20,000 square feet. It's so big. And in it, there are different dealers within it. And there's one place that I know and love, and they sell really beautiful things and at fair prices. And now I've been there, and every time I go, I will just buy one kind of pot or ceramic from one dealer, and, you know, $70 or something. And I like getting it while I travel. I like the connection to Maine. I like remembering that I like seeing it and knowing I got it there. And those are things that I didn't know I wanted before. And that, I feel like you still, if you're traveling and the object is connects you to a place and it's specific to that place, that can be a good thing.
Yeah. I think if you can, I think it's harder to sort of find that. And it's not something I want to dwell on, but you know, a lot of times you just go to places and see the same things and it's kind of feels like everything's the same. In Japan, I've fallen for that a little bit, but I've also been pretty careful about, I think I would get wrapped up in the merchandising of things, and sure, the way that they would present things then would be very compelling. And I would almost buy something and then think, let me like look at if this is on Amazon in the US, and just on your phone, look, and you're like, oh my gosh, it is on Amazon, you know? And it, which is kind of, it's crazy. And then you just think like, I almost fell for this, you know, this presentation, which isn't the worst thing in the world, but
it's funny, the flip side of that and what I tell guys is that if you are ever in a place and you see shoes that you like or an overcoat that you like, you should act, because I've seen a ton of, like, actually incidentally, Crockett and Jones shoes in Japan, and I was like, well, it seems weird to get an English shoe in Japan. I'll get it when I'm in London or in New York or something.
And but then they come back. It'll be special, right?
They're completely special, yeah. And they're only available in Japan, and naturally they're like brilliantly designed and very kind of just so. And I think that I feel like we're, in a weird way, what we're talking about is balancing the discipline and also balancing like the impulse. And sometimes the impulse is good and sometimes the impulse is bad. And then the bad part, we remember the mistakes we made, and and the discipline can is generally good. But sometimes it's like nice to buy something. And sometimes I will see something and I know it's strange and I can't even wear it, but I'll get it because I'm like, in 2 years, I'll be ready for this, which I realize is a very obscure, weird way to
be. Yeah, no one does that.
But sometimes I'm like, this is so, like, why is this thing having a power over me? Like, I actually in Isetan in Tokyo, I just bought a knit tie that was this very odd oatmeal light color. I don't like light colored ties. But the thing was very strong. It really had some force. And so I brought it back. And once I wore it around some serious clothing people, and they've commented on it because it had this weird thing that sometimes you have to give into that. And sometimes it's nice. Like, it can be nice to buy a pot. Actually, when I go to Japan, and I know we always talk about Japan, but now I just say when I go there, I'm just going to buy one ceramic, like one pot, because they have such beautiful ceramics. And that's the thing I look forward to. And now I have from every trip, one pot one, and it's a nice thing. And then I usually, if my sister, I'm usually there with my sister, if she's not looking, I try to buy a bag. If she's there, she won't let me buy a bag. It makes it very difficult because they have such beautiful bags.
Yeah. You know, bags, it's funny. So one of the things I was thinking about in terms of just the, if you want to talk about our buying habits or preferences or whatever, you know, I have this tendency to love things that are truly overbuilt. So like Filson, like Filson's just like it's like heavier canvas probably than it needs to be. I mean, the idea there is that everything's meant to last forever. And, you know, the leather is really heavy and it makes everything heavy, But it's kind of bulletproof. And like Yeti is like that, where it's like they took the simple, you know, tumbler and just made it this, you know, the heaviest, most insulated, hardcore thing. And I, for some reason, I'm like super drawn to that idea. Like, where's the, I just want a Weber grill that isn't flimsy. Like, where's the heavy duty? Right. Like, I know there's other companies that do this, make grills like this, but I want like the made in USA, like hardcore heavy Weber with no plastic. Right. And like just the one. And if it's like $500 then, or whatever it is, like that's it. And I just buy one and then I never buy another one, you know?
I like it. But do you have many things that you find that you think, why is this so heavy?
No, it's hard to find that stuff.
Oh, I see. Actually. You're looking for it.
Yeah, I like brands that are like that, that are not heavy. Like, you know, it's funny because sometimes if I'm traveling with you, I'll bring like a bag with no wheels because of your like weird no wheel bag program. Like I do it to kind of humor you. I'm my own man. I don't need your approval on wheels on luggage, but and then every time I carry like the Filson duffel through an airport, I just think, why did I bring this bag? This is the worst bag to bring.
It's funny that you say that because I was looking, and this is my last Japan comment. Like in Tokyo Hands, they have on the ground floor, is their travel section. And that's a really unique department store. And they have just a ton of kind of treated ripstop fabric duffel bags but they're like $30. And if they were at any cult store in America or any other place, would be so much more than that. And they're so light. And they just have a ton of them with weird names like Mr. Traveler, or it'll be like Soho Boy or some total nonsense. And then, but they pack down and they're just selling them like it's nothing because they're so good at this. And so actually, I was with my sister and we each bought one because we had shopped so much. We would just like carry them the rest of the day, but they were so light and the opposite of things. I mean, what you're talking about with things being overbuilt, as someone who like wears too much wax cotton and loves Filson bags and loves heavy things. Sometimes I'm always dealing with this contrast between old fashioned things that I like and a more technical version that is better. Probably, but often I don't like the way the more modern version looks. And so I have to decide when do I cross over? When does the modern version work so much better that I can no longer party like it's 1959 or whatever.
That's like outdoor stuff. Like if you had a sleeping bag, like you don't want like, or a tent, you know, it's like that technology is just so much better now and in every aspect of the product.
It really is incredible. Someone was asking us last week about Gore-Tex, and I have this Valence jacket courtesy of our friend Chris Black. And it's so, I mean, if you showed this to someone who wasn't caught up in what's going on, it's truly incredible just the way it fits together and the weight of it. And, or even just a freaking Patagonia zipper, I guess they call them a zipper sweater. It's like a down sweater, which everybody has. Like that is an incredible thing. That did not exist in 1950. It's so warm and so lightweight.
Dries quickly. Yeah, it's like all those other things that like, you know, all those other pain points that have been solved, you know. You know, I guess the problem with that stuff is it's all plastic, you know, and it's not really.
Yeah, I guess sometimes it seems like Patagonia is explaining to you where it's from or what it does. And because they give such a long description that I stop reading, I presume it's like recycled or something. But
You hope. Yeah, I mean, I think that they're trying to move to recycle a lot of recycled materials and, you know, mono content of fabrics is really important, right? Because it you can't really recycle mixed fabrics. Mm. You know, so like you want it to be all polyester or all, you know, all organic cotton or whatever. The materials thing, I think that's like going to be the future. And, you know, I think a lot of people now are really starting to take it seriously. Mm.
I wanted to ask you, we're just talking about buying and acquiring things. Are there certain things that you've wanted for a long period of time and worked toward? Because I feel like there was at one point a watch that meant something to you if you arrived at a certain point in your life. Are there things like that that you've dealt with where you kind of, it represented something, you work towards that thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they were always sort of like, there's certainly things that are like everyday things that I want that I maybe won't pull the trigger on until I, you know, like I'll use my points for my credit card to do it, you know, something I wouldn't buy. Like I actually just bought like a pizza oven, one of those like little, the Uni ones. And I just like wouldn't buy it, wouldn't spend the money because I could make it in my other grill and whatever. Eventually I was just like, I'm just going to use these points to do this.
Because it feels like an indulgence or something.
Yeah, like I don't really need it, but I would like it. And so the points like feels like a good compromise because what am I going to do with that anyway? But there's been bigger superficial things like a watch. I think like I remember looking at a watch and then thinking one day I'm going to come back and get this thing like when I get to the point where I can do it. And then I did it and that felt really great and I still own it. And I look at it now and it reminds me of that and it's more... Mm-hmm. I think it's nicer almost in the memory of the accomplishment than the thing. And I've done that with cars and stuff, but now I think once you start to do that stuff, you realize like there's this feeling that I get from these things doesn't really mean all that much.
Yeah.
So, you know,
well, the second half of your life, buddy.
Like, yeah, exactly.
That's everything. I mean, I feel like it's a meaningful, there's nothing embarrassing about that to me. Like we all want, there are things that signify something to us it could even be an experience. Like I want to stay at this hotel or I want to eat at this restaurant or I want to drink this bottle of wine or I want to go to this sushi place. I feel like those things matter, even if it seems irrational. And in a way, the irrational part kind of makes it better. Like I you know, we were talking about like Do you hear my church, synthetic church bells going off in the background here?
Is that your house?
Yeah.
Your cue to meditate? Is that your like self-care?
I live next to a church and once a week at Sunday morning at 11, they actually ring the bells, which are beautiful. But other nights they play synthetic bells. And if someone's over, they're like, oh, that's nice. And I'm like, actually, it's not, because they can play disco. Like, they can play YMCA or U2 songs. I don't know how it's like a ringtone for a synthetic
bell. Always certain people are going to get that reference. I'm too young, far too young to understand what that means.
But I feel like it's good to kind of be thoughtful about why we buy things. And then there's also, we do have to keep a little bit of space in our life for kind of madness, you know, and like the madness can be good, you know, or a gesture or something a little bit extravagant can be wonderful. And I think as we get older and know ourselves better, then we can calibrate more carefully what those things mean. But if I'm, you know, there's some joke, like if, not a joke, it's like if you drank wine and all wine was in clear bottles, no one would want an expensive wine. They're paying for the label or some other experience. And like, obviously that's true. You know, like if they didn't set down the, you know, the fancy thing in the restaurant or the fancy champagne, people it would really diminish the experience. But sometimes like that experience is fun. Like if I see you and you order a nice bottle of wine, you're communicating something to me and you're saying, we're celebrating or we're having a good time. Yeah. I'm happy to see you. And even if it's like, yeah, it's a little bit illogical to buy a fancy Barbaresco, but the experience can still be good. It doesn't mean you do it every week or even every month, maybe do it once a year, but that can be nice, you know?
Even if you do it, even if every time you do it, I feel like wine is an interesting example because a lot of good wine is made in a very difficult way, or there's a lot of other elements to it than just the label. And sometimes that's the case, or where it's from, you know, if it's a Bordeaux or if it's, you know, smaller batch or whatever those things are. I think sometimes like if you know who a winemaker is and you know how they produce the wine, then it becomes, it's worth it to spend the money, you know? You know, I look around at, sometimes I'll be at a restaurant. I don't really feel bad about buying good wine because I feel like you're in that same thing that I'm just saying, like you're putting that money towards a good cause or towards a continuation of a craft or whatever that is. But I do oftentimes sit at a restaurant and look at people's, look at the glasses they bring out for people, and then feel bad, like if the glasses aren't big, it's like if you get the
wine that's subpar compared to yours, and you've got like
you haven't ordered a nice enough wine to get the really good glasses.
Sure.
Then that's like, and it's like just knowing that I think is debilitating to some degree, where it's like, I shouldn't know this. You know, because I was just,
you want the large glasses for sure.
Yeah. Then you like fixate on that, right. You know, like I'll be at some place and be like, oh no, like they're getting the big glasses. And I, you know, my whole life, I tried not to be the person that, you know, the sort of like Woody Allen reference of like, you know, we got the bad table or whatever, right. You know, like in some restaurant. I don't know if that's actually a Woody Allen reference, but I feel like it would be.
Siberia.
It's like, yeah, exactly. Siberia. But it's, I wanted to ask you though, it's interesting because for me, like, I'm not someone that needs sort of everything to be, I mean this in a good way. And we're just different in the sense that I feel like everything you own is very considered, where sometimes I go like a little crazy and just like will indulge in impulse that is maybe, you know, outside of what someone would expect me to be wearing or using or owning.
You mean there's like you do something that's low, not lo-fi, maybe even lowbrow, and I wouldn't do that because I'm too much of a goddamn snob. Is
basically. yeah, you're an enormous snob, and
To me, like I grew up in a family where like we loved things and objects and books and antiques and all of that can be good. It doesn't have to be good, but in a real, really pulling back is like everything to me is a chance to express your sensibility. Everything is an opportunity to do that. I mean, this is some real Coggin stuff, so it's not for everybody. But like, I would never wear white socks. I would never own black socks. Like socks are, if you have to wear them, should be like something that you like. And I use that as an example of something seemingly insignificant. But like, I like the fork I have, or I like that. And that takes a huge amount of effort to be that way. But it's sort of the way that I grew up, which I realize is like insane, but not insane because my parents are they just loved design and they love living a certain way. And you have you have some nice kind of linen napkin, and that can be a nice thing. And that, I don't think that everybody should be that way, but it's nice to at least be exposed to it a certain way. And that's why if I visit someone's house or a hotel or something where they seem to get pleasure out of things that might be overlooked, like water glasses or ashtrays or matchbooks, I always get some pleasure from that because it seems like they've considered a lot of things. And it just makes the world a little richer. It's not even about snobbery. It's not about something that announces your sensibility to other people. Sometimes it's just for yourself. And if I see somebody has a really nice pen, I think they probably get pleasure from that. And I like that. I like the idea that they have a nice notebook in their pocket. So that's kind of the way I look at the world.
Do you ever feel weighed down by that?
I think at some point I did. And then I realized that I maybe cared too much about certain things. And then I hope I corrected and found what made sense for me. So it's at some point, if we're talking about buying things, I probably cared too much about like a certain fancy dress shirt or a certain fancy wine. And then I was like, you know, sometimes you want the expensive wine and the expensive dress shirt. And sometimes you want the everyday wine and just a regular Oxford shirt. And you can kind of navigate that and know when you just want to eat like sardines basically, or whatever in oil, and when you want it at something fancier. And I think for me, I think about this stuff way too much. I write about it. I advise people about it, and not that they should even do it my way, but I do think it's nice to know. And I like being in places like France or Italy or Japan where people care about these things too, even if they execute them in a totally different way than I would do it. Mm-hmm. And I think at a certain point, then you can, like, I don't see it as a burden. I see it as an opportunity. And that can be nice.
Yeah, that's cool. I appreciate that you're like that. I don't necessarily want to be like that because sometimes I, you know, and I think you grew up with it. It's like what you know. And I think it's also, you know, you have this appreciation of it, which is meaningful to you. And to me, I think sometimes having rules around I won't wear denim or I won't wear white socks, like, to me, I just don't want to be like caught up in those thoughts of things I can't do, you know?
I guess it in we at some point it's like this is the way I wouldn't say it's definitely rules and there, but at a certain point you internalize them. So it would be the way that you just make coffee a certain way and you wouldn't make instant coffee, right? Like you just develop a love for something and then it becomes part of your life and you're getting your Bixby coffee and you're making it in a nice way. And it just, it becomes natural to you. And the same way you like, you know, when I grew up, like nobody cared about where water was from. It was water. And now there's like a filter or there's a this or there's a that, or it's got to go through these things. You're putting cucumbers in it or some who knows what. And like, you know, every woman in my life is like, you can't just like, yeah, I'm drinking out of the tap. I don't care. But that's like, maybe that's the thing that I don't care about. But the idea is like, not that it's that it's not like you're looking at it as, oh, this is a rule. I like dressing this way, or I like the same way someone likes drinking coffee.
You're twisted. That way. It's fine.
Really?
You don't need to justify that you're twisted. It's cool, man.
Well, it's not, I guess I just, my only thing is like, it's not about the constrictions of it and the rules of it. It's more about the opportunity to do something in a way that you like, the same way that when you make a pizza or cook it in the Green Egg, yeah, or whatever. Like a thousand things that you do, and which is really interesting to me, is I see like you embracing certain things in your life and making them part of your life and traditions and the way you cook and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, I'm just really giving you a hard time, but I don't think it's that, you know, I think it's good that you do you and it makes you happy, and I think that's the important thing. In all of this is that, and the people I think lose sight of the fact that you should just do what makes you happy. It doesn't matter. Like, you're not doing things for other people. You should just do them for yourself. And that's sort of my guiding philosophy around getting dressed. And I do think that if you get dressed in a certain way, what it says about you is a signal to people that can be positive, and it doesn't need to be looked at as a frivolous thing. It can mean that you care deeply about these things, which means you're a considerate person, you know. It's all of the, with the pandemic and all of this stuff, though, it made me think, it's made me think a lot about being a rule follower and sort of what it means to be American and sort of how we want to, I'm trying to phrase this correctly. You know, I think that there's been a sort of schism between people that maybe should follow the rules and don't want to follow the rules. And I think part of that choice is inherently American. And it feels, you know, this feels like an interesting moment to take all of that stuff in. And I, you know, I never really realized until the pandemic, just like how sort of deeply ingrained personal freedoms are in America and how much of a big guiding factor that is. And I personally don't want to live someplace where if you take your garbage cans out 2 days early, you get, you know, you get a citation, or, you know, it's like, there's so many rules, like you can't just do what you want. Mm. But I also don't want to live in a place that's people can't follow any rules and it puts everyone at risk, you know? So it's like, it's just been an interesting thought, and it makes me think about just rules in every aspect of your life. And I guess like to some degree, I want to follow rules, and then to some degree I don't.
Yeah. It's an interesting, it's an interesting balance. And one reason that I wrote Men and Manners was that I was thinking about what it means to be in public and what it means to be considerate to other people and what it means to do things for someone that isn't about ourselves. And that was very minor things about, you know, being out in a restaurant and nothing to do with pandemics or masks. But I do think that there is something that we might struggle with, that I feel like it's a false connection to say like personal liberty means I'm allowed to do whatever I want. And that is some sort of old American value that if I can't drive this ridiculous SUV if I can't drive a Hummer that gets 8 miles a gallon, then we're living in a socialist country. That's nonsense, right? And I think like you can be expressive and you can live in a way that reflects who you are, at the same time thinking about the health and, or forget the health, but just the decency of what it means to be around someone else, whether it's not smoking around them or not speaking loudly on your cellular telephone or taking your bare feet out and putting them on the train seat opposite you, which are all, you know, minor things, but still really communicate that you don't give a damn about anybody else. And so now we're seeing that ratcheted up into a way that's upsetting, alarming, and shouldn't really be how the we're looking at it through the wrong filter, I think. And when people are, and then there's something in the New York Times today saying men don't want to wear masks because it's not masculine. And it's just, this is insanity. I mean, to me,
I think it is definitely a big cultural jump. And I do think to some degree, like I never expected, you know, mask wearing to be, obviously we're going through a pandemic and that's why, but you know, just all the years of going to Japan too and seeing sick people wear masks, which is considerate, them being considerate for other people. Right. And I think as an American, and when you first see that, it's hard to understand. And then you get a sense of like, there's the community, right? A sense of community. Right. And I think, I don't know, like, it's like people leaving negative reviews on the internet or leaving mean comments or saying bad things because there's anonymity and there's no sense of community. And I think that's the biggest sort of disappointment in all of it, where it's like, it's not that hard of a thing to do, even if you don't like believe, which is on you if you don't want to believe it, you know. But it's like, if you're going into someone else's restaurant, that's their business. You know, right. I think like you just need to follow their rules. I don't know. I don't want to make this like a referendum on mask wearing, but you know, I think it's not like the biggest thing in the world, where you know, biggest sacrifice. And I feel like we probably would have had a better summer if like it could have just happened, you know, regardless of like your take on all of it.
Yeah. I think the problem was that it became associated with some sort of political identity, which it never should have, that shouldn't have happened. And if we want to take it way down, it's like a dress code, right? Yeah. That's something else. Like if you went to a restaurant and they want you to dress a certain way,
you know, do that. Yeah, totally. You know, what's funny, unrelated, just to get off of that topic slightly. Golf clubs are like the worst dress places on earth, and they have like the most strict dress codes. So, you know, you do the math on that.
No, it's funny. I was years ago, I was in Los Angeles. This was like before Uber, before everything. And somehow, like, I didn't want to rent a car. I just didn't want to drive. And I was staying in downtown Los Angeles in a place called the Jonathan Club, which was a reciprocal club to the Minneapolis Club where I used to be a member. And it, before I discovered that it was kind of a...
out of the way.
Well, all sorts of things. And I was in this place that was very formal, which I kind of enjoyed, and really nice service and everything about it. And in a beautiful old building. And I found their list for their dress code, including they had I think they owned a golf club further up or worked with a golf club, had partnership with a golf club further up, probably past Malibu or something. And they had like a 3-page dress code describing what you could wear within the golf club, like a collared shirt if you were having dinner and these types of trousers. And it was like an incredible, like everything I needed to know about golf in California was in these 3 pages, because it was like, obviously they've had issues. Like someone wanted to wear shorts, someone wanted to wear spikes, someone wanted to wear all these things. And they had to like, it was like, you know, like a bill before Congress. It was the most detailed. It was like something from the IRS.
Do they have the card though? So I stay at this members club in New York a lot of times when I go, and they just have a card that says, it's like an Excel spreadsheet. You have to, you know, figure out what room you're in at what time on what day, and then see where you could wear denim and where you can't. But it's actually getting more relaxed. But all those things are pretty crazy. I mean, I love staying at reciprocal members clubs though. It's just such a different experience than being in a hotel, just because you don't the tourist aspect of it or whatever. But I remember asking you about clubs in London and being like, have you ever stayed here? What do you think? And even one place I remember you said, that place, they have so many rules that they're, and they just live to enforce them, that I wouldn't do it.
Oh, and I got my ass kicked. I mean,
what happened?
Well, I mean, I think most people listening to this would consider me to be a fairly formal person. And when I'm in London, like, I got destroyed at the East India Club, where I stayed a million times. Like, you couldn't bring a bag anywhere into the thing, even if it was a small bag, which I understand they don't want people like bringing luggage, but like, it may be it. And they're like, they would run after you. And they would, you know, I wore a scarf once, and it was like a dress scarf. It wasn't like wrapped around in a huge thing. The bartender told me that I had to take it off. Everyone who worked at that place at some time told me some rule that I'd broken. I mean, it is true that once I went in there with a suit and espadrilles and they wouldn't allow me in, which I deserve. But like other times, like, I mean, they just,
espadrilles are like, I mean,
no, I was pushing it there. But other times, I mean, they just are dying to come into, and I think I got my revenge by like posting a photo on Instagram in like Churchill Room or someplace that I wasn't allowed to do it. But,
you know, I always think like, I'm just going to head straight to my room, you know, because if you're going to or coming from your room, then you're pretty much like, right, fine.
You can't stop though. Don't stop.
Don't go to the bar.
Got to keep moving.
I stayed in January in London. I stayed at the Royal Automobile Club.
Oh.
And which is pretty huge, and they have a pool downstairs. Yeah, pool in the basement, right? Yeah. And like a crazy like series of baths and saunas and whatever. It was a great place to be. And I actually swam in the pool, and I remember going down thinking like, I don't know what to wear, like going down to the pool. And then I was really nervous, like trying to go to the pool, just because I didn't want to break the rules and see, sure, you know, obviously I'm a dumb American, so what do I know? But it was really funny. I remember
Paul being Smith like, swims, you know, before work. So you could have been in the presence of greatness. Well, this is a very, very good conversation. I know we're not political, but wear masks, people. It's the least we can do. It's good to talk to you, Michael. I hope your hand gets better. I think you really,
I'm wearing a mask on my hand.
I feel like you're like, doctor, when can I, the first thing you're like, I'm afraid you've got a break, sir. And you're like, okay, be honest with me. When can I get back and play 18? That was the first thing that went through your mind.
I did think about it. And I thought about you though, when I was there, and I'll just tell this quickly and then we'll wrap this up. You know, they present you the options for colors for your cast.
Oh yeah.
And it's like all primary colors, no earth tones, nothing. And you know, what do you do in that situation?
That's a tough one. I mean, that's
what would you do, David? You'd probably commission like a special Drake's print.
Yeah, Drake's. We'll get him in. We'll see if we can get a really nice. I need to see some samples. It's got to be kind of a muted brown.
And, this is the Calkins orthopedic collection.
I was like, I'd like to see a World War II era hotel, like military wall color, and then we try to match that color to the thing from, you know, Brideshead Revisited, and everybody gets annoyed.
I heard you on How Long Gone and talking about your buff mask, and it's, and you were throwing in the disclaimers that people have told you it's probably not up to snuff.
I think that's true. I got to get a true mask.
Well, keep us posted on what you end up doing for that, because we're all really curious. That, you should just go full medical grade, I think.
I might just wear, you know, scrubs and like I'm...
You should get Filson to make you a mask, like the tin cloth, you know, wax canvas.
I can barely, you know, I live on the fourth floor, it's a walk-off. I don't know if I can handle it very well. I'm still recovering from the How Long Gone. It's much easier to talk to you. Nice talking to you, Michael. Feel better. I'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Bye, David. Cheers.